My name is Dario Hasenstab. I have 2 degrees in international affairs, and I'm here with Balder Hagritz, a former university professor of mine, as well as an IR consultant. And together, we're bursting the Western bubble. Today, we will analyze religion through the lens of the Western bubble, because while Western societies have many strengths and significant weaknesses, in order to analyze these, we use the concept of the Western bubble. If you would like to know more about this concept, how this podcast started, or who we are, make sure to listen to our introduction episodes. Hi, Balder. Why are we speaking about this topic today? Why are we speaking about religion?
Hello, Dario. Today, the day of recording is the 24th of March, and we're now moving into Eastern territory. Today, Psalm Sunday in Catholic Spain, but there's also Ramadan for Islam, and there's Purim for the Jewish population here and everywhere around the world. And that seemed like a good moment with those three Abrahamic religions all celebrating their own festivities to have a conversation about religion more generally, because you and I have had conversations off the record. We've had conversations about religion without recording. You are Catholic, I'm atheist. And rather than having a normal standard episode, given these religious festivities this week, we thought we'd just have a conversation about religion, how we perceive it, as what its impact on the world is, and what our personal connections are to religion.
And this is also a bit of an excuse, right, to basically only publish the next episode in 2 weeks, right, to basically go on a bit of an Easter break. I will be traveling. I will actually be in Spain. We will be seeing each other. It will be very nice. But that means that the next episode after this one will come out in 2 weeks with a special guest that we will tell you about more in that episode. But let's start with, right, and our usual listeners might be missing the category here or the transition, but let's start with a little bit of facts, but without having a clear red fact sheet. And just looking a little bit at the division of religion or religious affiliation within the West. I'm going to start with Germany. Germany is interesting because it's basically a third Protestant, a third Catholic, and a third unaffiliated or 3.5% Muslim. Germany is evenly divided on that, but not necessarily divided, right? We're not talking about the divisions of religion that at least my grandparents told me about. Then in the UK, you have a lot of Protestants, fewer kind of Catholics, right? They're not really separated from other Christian groups in that sense there, but also a large group unaffiliated, about a quarter of the country. And then in the Netherlands, Balder, here we've, I was a bit surprised to see that there's so few Protestants, only 19%, but still 28% Catholic, and the majority of the population unaffiliated. Well, what's the matter with that?
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing. And most people think of, and probably historically absolutely should think of, the Netherlands as Protestant. Traditionally, historically, it was 65 to 70% of the population was Protestant, and 30% has been consistently Catholic. What has happened over time, over the past 100 years or so, is that the Protestant population has lost their faith, certainly have lost their religion, and has gone down, and the Catholic population has stayed relatively stable. That's particularly the population in the south. And my best guess is that that is because Catholicism is very closely connected to cultural traditions, to the typical things that you see here in Spain as well, where being Catholic is not just a statement of faith, but it's also a statement of lifestyle and all those kinds of things. And so the Protestants have had a hard time in the Netherlands, even though historically the Netherlands is absolutely one of the Protestant Calvinist countries.
Well, in Germany, I mean, I was actually a bit surprised by these numbers, because the churches have been losing members like crazy the past years, right? So there have been a lot of scandals about, like, right, sexual assault of minors within the church over the last, well, probably forever, right? But now you see that also people in higher up roles were kind of covering that up and protecting each other, and the churches are no longer playing that of an essential role within society. But I do think that most Germans will still largely affiliate themselves to one or the other, right? Without necessarily being a member of the church, because it also means you have to pay church tax. And if you don't go to church and you pay church tax, I mean, right, do you really want to give away an additional 10% of your salary?
It's worthwhile mentioning how far Germany has come in that sense, because also modern day Germany is the territory in which the religious war started, of course, where the Holy Roman Emperor was faced with this enormous clash that eventually led to the rupture of the Catholic Church and the all the different Christian affiliations that we denominations that we have nowadays. So Germany has a very interesting historical connection with Christianity, right?
Very interesting, right? I mean, you also have Martin Luther coming from here, and right. So I believe most listeners will probably have seen a map from Germany from 200 years ago, right? With basically 1,000 different kingdoms, right, or principalities in that sense. And at that time, it was the case that each basically ruler of the little principality, was basically the size of a town or a county, could choose their own religion and the religion of the people living there, which leads to really interesting divisions. So, for example, me, where I did my high school, was largely Protestant dominated. But then you would basically drive over a hill into the next town, and everyone would be Catholic, right? So you have some really interesting dynamics, and that also explains why the 30 Years' War was so bloody here, because if all your neighbors are basically of a different denomination, and you are taught to hate them or to dislike them, then yeah, killing each other makes. Well, it becomes very easy.
Does it play any role in German politics at the moment, religion?
No, not at all. That's one of the things, right? That's no, it really doesn't. The only thing, I mean, the churches have learned to basically take a step back. The only thing that they're very active and outspoken on is basically being against the far right. Right, against extremism, well, extremism on the far right, against racism. They are basically not as harsh on migration, right? Because they very much believe in love thy neighbor, and we're basically saying that, hey, some of the values that are being held by the far right are incompatible with the values that the churches stand for. But usually, when the churches here speak, they speak with a common voice, but they're also very careful because, right, the moment you basically stick out your head and you say hello, that's the moment where you basically expose yourself to possible criticism of, okay, why is the government collecting the taxes on behalf of the church, right? Which is a huge plus for the churches in Germany, because in other countries, I know that this is not the case. And so the churches are doing very well here, right? They're still being compensated for land being taken away from them hundreds of years ago. The churches are having a very nice life here in Germany.
That's similar, I guess, to Spain, right? Where the Catholic Church has also this kind of still, if you like, economic clout, even though politically maybe less so. But certainly when it comes to the same system of paying part of your taxes to the church, that's very typical here in Spain. And you would never see that in some other Western countries, obviously, where that separation is much more clearly divided.
Well, the Catholic Church is the biggest employer after the government in this country, right? So in right, and this is also the reason why, if you ask me, and you've already said, right, I'm Catholic, and I do pay my church taxes in that sense, right? I could opt out, but I do like the fact that, I mean, right, kindergartens are supported by churches, hospitals, any type of right support mechanisms for people in need. Right, I do think that the church here plays a positive role in that sense, right? And we can get deeper into that conversation later on, but you because you already mentioned Spain, and in Spain 94% of the people are affiliated Catholic. In Italy it's 80%, and in France it's 66. Right, so there's like a bit of a division within Europe here.
But certainly in Spain, so in Spain, highest of the three that you just mentioned. But I would argue, I hope I'm not offending anyone here, but ask your average Catholic in France, then they actually really mean it still from a religious perspective. Whereas in Spain, it is so integrated into Spanish culture that, First Communion and of course baptizing, it's a thing that you just do without even thinking about it, right? So a lot of people here in Spain who actually call themselves Catholic probably aren't Catholic in any significant religious or spiritual sense. Unlike a country where in France, where they actually have to think about it because France is actively secular.
Well, in Germany, we have the term submarine Christians. So they're basically underwater all year long. And then on Christmas and Easter, they suddenly are in church, right? Because the churches are suddenly filled. Today, the church was pretty full. So you kind of have people who will say, oh yes, I'm religious, right? But all that religious stuff is so much work. I'll just take the goodies, basically the benefits of religion in that sense.
I must say also with respect to those statistics, it is it very much depends on what is being asked and how it's being asked, right? And for example, the question, are you baptized, is very different from, do you consider yourself religious? And certainly in Spain, that because sometimes you see statistics on Spain that actually are much lower than the 94% when the questions actually are about, do you believe in Jesus Christ, etc., etc.
Yeah, and I mean, being religious, right, is such an interesting concept, right? Because it varies from, oh yes, I believe in a higher spiritual being, and I call that God because I was raised in Europe or the United States, or going all the way to the Bible basically dictates my everyday, kind of speaking of that, let's move on to the United States and Canada, because here it's interesting, right? So in the United States, about 50% of the population are Protestant, right? But there you have a lot of, I mean, the United States is very complicated with that, right? Because Protestant includes anyone from any denomination that's basically not Catholic. And a lot of smaller groups, right? So you have the Mormons part of this, you have different evangelical denominations, then the Jehovah's Witnesses are also part of that. So there's a large division. And then you have 24%, which are basically Catholic, which if you ask me, it must be due to the growing Hispanic population within the US, because that's a whole different thing that we will talk about maybe in another episode.
But what's interesting is that even though the Catholic population might be growing, the United States has always politically been actively a Protestant country. Despite its secular nature, despite separation of church and state, Catholics had a rough time in politics very regularly, right? There have only been two Catholic presidents, John F. Kennedy and now Joe Biden. And in that sense, the Protestantism has certainly defined the United States in terms of identity, in terms of historical evolution, very much like the Netherlands, by the way. But in the Netherlands, all those Protestants have left, and in the United States, most of them still remain loyal to the church.
And the last country we want to highlight is a country I don't know anything about. Canadians, please don't get mad at me. But you are basically Canadized the Netherlands of the North America, right? It's there, we all know it exists, but we can't really pinpoint it in relation to its bigger brother, right? United States or Germany in that regard. And Canada is 20% Protestant, 40% Catholic. Then there's smaller denominations, right? So you have smaller religions with Muslim, Hindu or Sikh, Buddhist, but then also with 24% unaffiliated. And that's just a wild mix.
Yeah, I mean, Canada and Netherlands, what they have in common is that they're two of the biggest agricultural exporters in the world. And so they're feeding all those Germans and Americans who need to eat every day. So you're very welcome. Canada is interesting in the sense that Canada has always had a more moderate identity politically, but also religiously in that sense, because it has never put itself forward with the clear voice that the United States has put itself forward, right? So in that sense, I don't think that religion has the same impact on Canada and how Canadians view themselves as it does in the United States, where religion has always and still is a very important fundamental part of how your average American perceives their country and themselves.
It certainly is. Let's take this to the next level. So basically to the bubble level and the Western bubble level. Because there is a connection between religion and the Western bubble. And I mean, we've spoken about this in the past. But what would you say kind of like the main thing is when we're talking about, okay, here, this and with this aspect in the Western bubble, we can definitely see religion.
Well, in many ways, you can break it up into two historical parts, sort of the early rise of Europe. Then we're talking about the Catholic empires, Portugal, Spain, that actually used religion as a driver, as a justification even for colonization, basically saying we need to bring Jesus Christ to the rest of the world now that we've got ships that can travel everywhere and we are starting to explore the world. It is our duty, if you like, to convert the rest of the world. And that was a very convenient excuse to basically conquer other peoples. And then with the decline of those empires and the rise of the French and especially British Empire and the Dutch Empire to a certain extent, religion no longer plays such a major part in it all, because Protestants, the British Empire and the Dutch, always have found it very difficult to use religion as a justification, right? The Catholic Church was much more proactive, if you like, in intervening in politics, and Protestantism by its very nature is less politically driven. And therefore, what you see is a shift of European empires no longer using religion as a justification for conquest, but then becoming kind of inherently arrogant because of their relationship with religion. Why? Not because the British are Protestant or the Dutch are Protestant, but because they actually start being proud of their French Enlightenment thinking and their secular thinking. Despite still being Christians, they start saying, yes, we are religious, just like Muslims, just like Hindus, but we are the reasonable religions. We are the ones who understand that you have to separate church and state. We understand that you shouldn't be extremist. And so it becomes a kind of moral narrative of saying, we are the evolved part of humanity because of our connection with religion. And that creates another enormous bubble and an enormous layer of arrogance in the way that the West deals with the rest of the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, and I mean, this is something we'll talk about later, but Redmond, when you described this, to me, the Western bubble is more and more becoming a religion, right? Not for me, but that for people out there who are stuck so deeply within these beliefs, that that's basically becoming their religion, right? That we have to, right, we have to educate the world about democracy and all the things that we hold so dearly, right? Just that, just saying that sounds like what the Catholic Church did in the 15th and 16th century.
And absolutely, what you see is that the narrative of basically having certain absolute truths that almost override any practical concerns are present in traditional religion and are present in the current Western bubble discourse. You mentioned democracy, but also human rights. In some ways, human rights is the Bible of pressing for a international relations narrative in the West, right? Like, we have to protect human rights, and that justifies us going into countries and invading them to protect the people from themselves. We can criticize China, we can criticize Iran, because we know that we defend some absolute truth called human rights. Very similar to the Jesuits and the Spanish and Portuguese empires of the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries.
Hmm. Yeah. Let's look at the role of religion nowadays in the West. So we already discussed Germany and the Netherlands. It's not very active anymore in that sense, right? It's no longer the first thing you turn towards to when you're thinking about policymaking, when you're thinking about what direction should we take society into.
It isn't, but at a more fundamental level, it very much still informs our way of thinking and our way of being, right? And maybe it's useful here to separate Europe, certainly Western Europe, from the United States, right? Because again, there certainly domestic policy in the United States is still very closely connected to religion, the whole debate between Republicans and Democrats, etc., etc. In Western Europe, less so. And I think in Western Europe, the secularism, kind of the rejection of one religion, right? Secularism is not atheism. Secularism is simply saying we have to be critical of religion, therefore the state should never be promoting one specific religion, has become a major part of the way that Western Europe views itself. As a result, Western Europe has no longer this kind of religious debate, neither internally nor externally. But the Judeo-Christian culture, history, values are still extremely visible, right? As we just discussed, this idea of basically promoting a set of values to the rest of the world, whether the rest of the world wants to hear about that or not, is very deeply ingrained. And that's very Abrahamic in nature. Abrahamic religions, well, Judaism a little bit less so, but much, very much less so, but Christianity and Islam have always had this tendency to say, not only are we convinced of us being right, but we have a duty to impose that on everyone else. And that is something that now in the West is still very visible, except that it has turned to democracy, human rights, liberalism, capitalism, those kinds of things.
Yes, it has. Oh, well, I mean, right, this is going to be a very interesting conversation when it comes to, okay, what, right, how much is the Western bubble actually a substitute religion? But before we get into this, we kind of promised the listeners that we would briefly talk about ourselves here, right? And this is something that we've done maybe in the introduction episodes, and we've done it like very, very much at the beginning of this podcast where we usually discussed our own bias. But we do have different views on spirituality and therefore religion, right? And it's, I mean, it's obviously difficult to define here. And I think the two of us over the course of many hours have talked about this. And I think we now have a pretty good understanding of where we are. And we hope that this makes the conversation a bit easier to understand for the listeners as well. Balder, you are an atheist. What does that mean?
It's fascinating because I still find it interesting that in 2024, there are significant groups within Western population, but certainly worldwide, that hear the word atheist and have all kinds of like loaded reactions to that, as if it is some kind of horrific position to take, right? And I want to just clarify, atheism simply means that I lack a belief in God. So yes, I do not believe in a God. I do not know if there is a God or not. In that sense, technically you would call me an agnostic atheist, because I don't think we can have any knowledge on a God, but I do not have evidence for a God, therefore I do not believe in a God. Well, let me rephrase that. I do not have good evidence for a God, therefore I do not believe in a God, because of course there's some evidence here and there. And therefore that is simply it. And I'm an atheist. I would argue, and this is not me saying this, but there have been many people made this argument, that someone who is a Christian is also an atheist with regard to all other gods except for one, right? So a Christian doesn't believe in Allah, for example. Therefore, they're an atheist. They do not believe in Allah, but they still believe in the Christian God, in Jesus Christ and the Holy Trinity, etc., etc. So, yes, I'm an atheist. This comes from just my background. I've always been raised in a secular environment, and both my parents were atheists. My father, interestingly enough, for the first 30 years of his life, was a devout Catholic. Seriously devout, as in even going to seminary, and there was talk about him going into a religious career at some point. And one day, around the age of 30, well before I was born, he woke up and he said, "I just don't believe anymore." And that was it. But what I'm very grateful for is that because he was so devoutly Catholic for the first 30 years of his life, and I'm saying 30 years, that's important because it's not just as a child where you just believe what your parents tell you to believe, right? As an intellectual adult in his 20s, as a student, etc., etc., he was still Catholic. And what I'm very grateful for is that because of that Catholic background of his, he's always made me interested in religion in a positive, constructive way, because he never rejected it as some kind of horrible, evil conspiracy, but simply as something that he didn't believe in anymore. But for example, I had to read the Bible. We would listen to a lot of Catholic or Christian music. We would always be in awe of the amazing cathedrals that were being built in the name of Jesus. So in that sense, I've always had a close connection to Christianity, certainly to Catholicism, but not as a believer.
Well, I believe this feeling of, oh, he's an atheist, comes from, and I'm so sorry I have to bring up this joke, right? But it's basically like someone being a vegan, right? It's like, how do you know someone's a vegan? They tell you immediately. It's right, and I mean, it's I know of many people in my surroundings, right? They kind of they would always jump onto the opportunity on someone saying, oh, you know, I believe in X, and then they would jump onto it. Oh yeah, but you can prove it. And it's like, yeah, but once again, careful here. This is a deeply personal thing, right? Nobody asked for this conversation, but you're basically bringing it on because, oh, you're an atheist, right? So most people I know of who are atheists, I know that because they've proclaimed it, right? And it was very important to them to kind of bring that. So I think that maybe of people who are religious, I think that maybe this is a little bit where the frustration comes from. At least that would be my theory.
Yeah, no, there's probably some of that. I think that there is also, so there's a real risk of inherent arrogance when it comes to atheism, right? Like, oh, I'm cleverer than everyone else because I'm intelligent enough to see that there is no God, or at least to see that there's no evidence for God. So I think there's certainly a part of that. And for my, if you like, my journey, initially as a older teenager and when I was a student, I found new atheist literature very useful to structure my thoughts. I'm talking about people like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens. They allowed me to understand my thinking, but very quickly I turned off them because of this inherent arrogance, right? So after them helping me to understand what atheism actually means and how we get there, because for me it had always been just a thing without question, I started noticing the aggression that they have towards religion, the aggression that they have towards people who believe, and sort of the act of looking down on them and believing that they're somehow intellectually inferior for believing. And that's where I think we should get very nervous. And I think that's kind of the ugly side of atheism. On the other hand, I also think that there's one aspect why people who, certainly people who are religious, who at least say that they believe in God, react quite shocked very often, or quite, you know, like, oh, what is this? Is that it often is confused with someone saying, oh, I believe that there is no God. And there's an important difference there. Saying I do not believe in a God is not the same as I believe there's no God. I'm not arguing that someone who's Christian is wrong. I'm just saying that I do not have evidence to follow that same line of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, well, for me, right, it's, if you ask me right now, do I have a scientific evidence, right, according to scientific method and so on and so forth, that there is a God, and particularly that there will be a Christian, Catholic, whatever you want to call it, God, I would probably have to say no, because I've not to my knowledge, at least. But that's right. That's not necessary. And that's the reason why I never engage with these conversations with atheists, right? Because it's spirituality and being religious is something deeply personal for me. So I never felt the need to discuss this with anyone else. I mean, I do remember that throughout university, right? People would only very late learn about me that I'm religious, because it's nothing that I personally carry in front of me. It's nothing that I think in my daily life I will not quote from the Bible very much, and so on and so forth. It's something very deeply personal for me, and something that guides my life a little bit and also makes my life a lot easier in that sense, right? Because I don't have to ask myself very big questions, right? In that sense of, I mean, I've once in our previous conversation said that I think people who do not believe in a higher power that they've put into a framework of religion, I think that they live a very sad life, because then you don't know what's coming after death. That might be scary, right? I don't have to ask myself that scary question, because I very much believe that there is something coming after death, right? And that because of my socialization, I am Catholic, and so therefore I will have the Catholic interpretation of spirituality. I also believe that how can I explain to myself that someone across the border believing in a different interpretation of spirituality is wrong? Right? I don't believe in this whole shtick of religions telling each other that they are wrong, and it is only one true God, and it's the one that we believe in because for some reason we have found the ultimate truth. But that for me, that there is a you could almost call it a Hegelian interpretation of there is a higher power, right? Like he called it a world spirit. And so philosophers call it a worldly spirit. The Christians call it the Christian God. Muslims call it Allah, the Jews call it Yahweh, and then we can extend this list towards all others, right? But I think that there is some form of spirituality in the world that somehow connects the world, that somehow is the reason why we're all here, and that we as humans have created different interpretations of that. And these interpretations are very much based on our upbringing, our cultural environment. And I always liked that very much, right? I always find it very beautiful because, let's be honest, when you're traveling abroad, that's the first thing you look at, right? You look at the temples of people, you look at their interpretation of the world. And to me, that's always a fascinating thing and something very beautiful. And right, just because you have said that, yes, there's atheists who kind of carry it around and are very arrogant about it. I mean, no doubt are there people out there who have interpreted a religion in a very wrong way, right? I mean, this is 2 days after that horrific attack in Moscow, right? Which, according to everything that we know so far, was also done with religious motives. Yeah, I mean, no shit. Sorry for my language, but yeah, religion has been used in horrific ways all over human history.
Right, and also a lot of the ugliest parts of Western bubble history are religiously motivated, of course. And I think that's probably one of the main concerns that atheists have with religion, right? I mean, they don't really typically... So, well, let me speak for myself. I have absolutely no negative reaction internally or externally towards someone saying, I believe in God, but I become nervous when it becomes part of policymaking. When it becomes part, because then now you have to show me evidence of why this is the right thing. So if you say, I believe in God, you have no obligation to show me any evidence. But if you say, because of my belief, I want this to happen to the law, for example, I want to ban abortion or something like that, at that moment, we have to have a conversation about evidence. What is going on here? For you, though, this has been part of your upbringing, right? It has never been in Frage, it has never been in question whether you're Catholic or not, or has it?
No, I have Italian roots in that sense, right? So my mother's side, very Catholic. It was clear that I was baptized, right? And the Catholics, they're a bit smarter about it than the Protestants, in my opinion. They don't ask you, they just baptize you, right? It keeps the retention rate higher. And for me, it was very clear that I would do the communion. And that was a bit, I don't want to say imposed, but it was very much expected. And also, right, and that typically happens at the age of 8, and only then with a confirmation, which usually happens around 14, 15, 16, depending on how many kids you have to form a group with. Only then my parents were very open about, hey, this is a choice for you. Right? I mean, I can also say that my mother is Catholic, my father is a Protestant, but both of them have a lot of Buddhist teachings in their way of life, right? So their interpretation of a higher power is Catholic or Protestant, but their way of spirituality is very much Buddhist. So for me, it was never a very strict way, right? And then it was clear that for the confirmation, right? I mean, that's basically what it is. You have to make the choice for yourself whether you actually want to follow this. And for me, I said, I find this very convincing, right? I mean, hey, I get to continue living after I die, right? And I'm going to be in heaven at the side of God. It sounds like a very nice place. I get to be in paradise. That's amazing. Wow. They're really selling it well. And so for me, it has never come into question, particularly because I've never made it the guiding principle of life choices. Right. So I never said that, oh, because I'm Catholic, I have to go to Spain to do my bachelor's degree. No, I mean, it never had an impact on policy making directly. It definitely had an impact on my life choices. Right. Simply because of how you live your life, because there's so many teachings and there's a certain way of life you're supposed to follow. So in that sense, yes, but it never got to the level of policymaking where I said, oh, because, I don't know, because of this verse in the Bible, I now have to, I don't know, do X, right?
It's interesting what you're saying about your belief system is very much that of, I would argue more of a theist, like there is a higher power. And I believe that in the past you told me you don't like the word path, but that there are different paths, whether it's Judaism or Christianity or Islam or Buddhism that reach that spiritual higher power, right? And that is something that clearly then also comes from your parents, from your parents' approach to their own religion. Just like in my case, my atheism comes from my parents who never doubt, it was never a part of the conversation, because obviously from their perspective, there's no evidence for God. So we just move on. There's nothing really to talk about, right? So how we are influenced by parents is very clearly visible when it comes to religion.
Of course, it's all about socialization. I mean, do we honestly believe that if I was born in Indonesia, I would be a Catholic? Please forgive my ignorance. Maybe there are Catholic groups within Indonesia. But largest Muslim population in the world. So I'm pretty sure I would be Muslim, and then I would see the world through basically like spirituality through the interpretation of Islam. So for me, that's a very clear thing, and that's the reason why the only time that I get upset with religious people is when they start excluding based on religion, right? When they're saying that, oh no, my interpretation is right and yours is wrong because of this book that I read, which happens to be very similar to yours, but just is interpreted in different ways.
But in that case, are the details of religion then important to you at all? In the sense that if you're saying there is this higher power, we can't really... I think you're relatively agnostic on the nature of that higher power, right? Because I believe that, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but that you don't think that we can know the exact details, that we know the exact supernatural aspects of it all. And in that case, is it important to have these different details within each religion? Is it important to actually call yourself Catholic or Muslim or Hindu if everyone is just talking about a vaguely defined concept that's out there?
Important for me or important for society?
Well, important for you, I guess for both, but let me ask it for you personally. Is it important for you to call yourself Catholic rather than someone who believes in a higher power and who is part of a Christian society and tradition and culture?
So I'm going to give you the Dario answer, right? The very practical one. Catholic is shorter than the other sentence structure you just created, right? It's identity, right? I mean, being brought up in Catholic ways is identity. So I feel, right, I do see the differences to my friends on how we were brought up. I mean, there's always this, so when I started school, primary school, right, you have a mass but together with the, right, all of them are together, the Catholics, the Muslims, the Protestants, the Jews, we're all sitting there. And then if there's enough representation, right, you have a priest or an imam or, right, fill in the blank, right, with the corresponding word. And we as kids, we never saw each other in such different ways. The only difference was that my confirmation was a bit later than the one of my friends. So no, for me personally, this will not be important. I think it's, as with everything in life, right? It's an easy box to kind of use to be like, hey, I'm Catholic. So immediately someone else will have an idea of, okay, I for example put a little Jesus on the cross while the Protestants don't do that, right? So that's a detail there. I kneel down to pray. Some other Protestants don't do that, right? There's differences in how you fold your hands. Then there's actual differences with regards to the interpretation of scriptures and so on and so forth. But because for me, it has always been something deeply personal, I always said I couldn't care less. Please interpret your religion as you want it, right? And now to speak with John Stuart Mill, right? Basically, your freedom can only go as far as long as it does not interfere with other people's freedoms. And the same for me is with religion, right? So my spirituality, as the moment it interferes with someone else's spirituality, it becomes a problem for me.
And you said previously that an important part of your spirituality, of your faith, is the comfort that you get out of it. The comfort, for example, of life after death, to name the big one, right? Which is a consistent pattern throughout religions. And that is a big deal, obviously, for humanity, because here, at least on Earth, we have our mortal coil. We're all going to die at some point. And knowing or believing that you know that you're going to go to another place afterwards can bring a lot of comfort, and not just for you, but also for your loved ones. That your loved ones who already died, they are up there and they're waiting for you and they will embrace you. But if that is something that is important to you, does that mean that you believe that every religion can lead to that grace of God? So basically that a Hindu or a Muslim will also find that afterlife, will also be received well by God?
Yes.
So in that sense, it doesn't matter whether someone is baptized or not for you, from your perspective. In your philosophical framework, it doesn't really matter whether someone calls themselves Christian or Hindu, or they will all, as long as they lead good lives and they're good people, they will receive the ultimate reward, if you like.
Yes, anything else makes no sense to me. Right, but that's a very personal thing. I know that many out there will now disagree. Right, and this is my personal conviction, because right, I mean, let's take the example of being baptized or not. that would be a very selective higher being, right? To say, and then there's always this example of right, the reason why Catholics baptize their children so early is because what happens if they die before, right? But what happens if the child dies in the womb of the mother, right? And I know that now there are passages within the scriptures that cover that basically, and there will be someone who will be able to turn words in a way that kind of makes it convincing for me, right? I mean, that's the nice thing about scriptures. You can interpret them the way you want to. And that's the reason why it's a very personal thing for me. But that's exactly the reason why I disagree with people the moment they start excluding others, right? The moment they say that, oh, because you weren't brought up in the same way I was brought up, that's the reason why you will not be receiving the afterlife.
Of course, I mean, obviously from my perspective, that those are comforting words to hear, right? thank you very much. It's the exclusivity and the aggression that often comes with that exclusivity that is scary about religion, right? And that's when things go horribly wrong. That's when bombs start being dropped and all those kinds of things. And then also that's when people start basically trying to mess with other people's lives in general. And then we have to be very careful. I'm just fascinated, and I don't think that there's a clear answer to this, but it seems to me that basically what you're saying is that you have a core belief, and that core belief gives you comfort and gives, but that really everything else about the way you get to that core belief, whether it's the Bible or whether it's the Quran or whatever, it really is just, these are little details that don't really matter in the bigger picture. That's fascinating, because then it sounds to me as more of a theistic approach rather than a religious approach, because religion is all about the details, right?
Yeah, it's exactly. It's all about the details. That's the reason why I differentiate so much between spirituality and religion, right? So I think that I can comfortably say that the majority of humanity is spiritual in any way, shape, or form, right? Otherwise, how do we explain that we've developed so many religions simultaneously to each other in all forms of society? Right, you can go into the Amazon rainforest and look at one of these uncontacted tribes, and they will have some form of interpretation of spirituality. And I'm going to be the atheist in that sense. I'm like, okay, so what's your proof that if any form of society on this planet, if they all come to some form of conclusion that there is a higher power, and that they have created an interpretation of it, then that for me is an incredibly strong proof, right? That there is spirituality and that there is a benefit in that. And the belief that there's a benefit in this, and then the interpretation of religion, obviously, because it just comes natural with it, that in itself is enough reason for me to say, oh, you know what, that's a very convincing concept. Thank you very much. I'll take that. Because it's comforting to know, right? It makes my life, I believe, a lot easier. Right, because I mean, there's also this notion of, hey, everything happens for a reason, right? You have influence over your life, but right, in case something terrible happens, right? In I don't know why, like, what's the explanation for a 7-year-old girl dying in a car accident? Right, that's I don't know. I mean, I always look at someone who doesn't believe in a higher power, and then I'm like, wow, that's That must be incredibly sad to believe that this girl just died and now she's not in a better place, right? It's a lot about comfort for me.
Yeah, but these are two different things that you raise, right? First is sort of the anthropological observation, which is a true observation, that religion has a clear, or spirituality, because there have been significant differences, right, between tribes, between different groups. They're not all pointing towards one god, for example, right? They don't all point towards gods at all. Buddhism, for example, is very different in that sense. But there is this inherent search for something spiritual in humanity. I think that is an objective, observable fact. The question is whether that search needs to automatically then lead to the conclusion that there must be something, right? It could just be that humanity, and that would be my interpretation, finds it difficult to deal with all the hardship and the pain, and therefore starts inventing something, not that it's there, but starts inventing it to give that comfort, because that comes to the second part of what you said. It is clear that the world is a tough place, is a hard place where small babies, without having done anything wrong yet, they die because of horrible illness or violence or anything like that. There's a lot of injustice in the world, and our human psychology finds it very difficult to deal with that. Especially, for example, let's say that something horrible happened to your family, someone murdered your family, and then that murderer leads a happy life for the rest of their days. Then there is enormous comfort in thinking, well, afterwards God will punish the murderer. Afterwards they will go to hell, or afterwards something bad will happen to them. In their lives, nothing. They killed my family. I can't give that a clear place. They walk free, but God will not let them get away with that.
See, but this is the right, and that I don't know if this tells me a lot about your psychology here in this moment, right? But when you brought up the example, my first thought was, oh, how comforting to believe that my family is now in a better place, right? I didn't think about vengeance. I didn't think, he will get what he deserves because he's a bad person. They're luckily within the Christian faith, you have a lot of emphasis on forgiveness, right? Which I do think is just healthy in general, right? But for me, the comfort element was very much to, okay, how can I now get past this? Without necessarily thinking about the negative consequences first. But that's just a little funny observation.
That is an interesting observation. I think it was slightly to add to what you said about comfort, but because basically what I wanted to point out is that our human psychology finds it difficult to deal with the hardship in life in general. And so the comfort aspect is part of that, but there's also a part of justice. And if there is no inherent justice in our world, and that would kind of be the atheist view, right? That there is no specific purpose. We can give life our own purpose. We can give ourselves goals. We can distinguish between a successful life and an unsuccessful life. But that purpose is not given to us from above. And therefore, without a clear purpose for all these things, it becomes very hard to deal with the injustice, the unfairness, but also the tough nature of life. And so in many ways, it's two sides of the same coin, right? To say, I find comfort in my belief, in my spirituality. And also I find some kind of justice in the idea that if someone doesn't lead a good life here on earth, they will get the consequences later. And that's all part of our human psychology.
Right, which ultimately leads to an incredibly effective way to govern society, right? And that's kind of the next point, right? The role of religion in society. And I mean, for me, religion has always been a tool to control the masses, a very effective one, because it's that thing, right? The feeling of, okay, they will get what they deserve. So I now don't need to take matters into my own hand and kill them, right? I mean, the stage before that actually was an eye for an eye. Right, is to basically stop the spiral of violence by saying, "Oh, you took out my eye, so now I'm going to kill you, because then your family is going to come and kill me, and or maybe I don't know my sister as well." Right, so there's also this governance aspect to religion, which I find right now not a lot on a personal level, but now more on a policy level, always a very interesting one to observe, how religion helps organize society.
And wouldn't that in a large part explain the issue that you raised before, that societies throughout humanity have developed their own form of religion because it is actually a useful, if you like, social Darwinian tool. It actually helps us stabilize things. In many ways, I think you could argue, I certainly would argue, that religion is a way of codifying the golden rule. The golden rule is do unto others as you would like them to do unto you. So basically be good to others so that others can be good to you, in a nutshell. And religion is a way to basically put that into a policy framework, into a governance system. And there, by the way, the punishment aspect is an important aspect, right? So that the eye for an eye, and I always have to think of Gandhi there, that it will turn the whole world blind. But in some ways, the idea of, hey, we kind of even have an inherent understanding of human morality. Why? Because of the golden rule. Because if I am unjust to you, then you are unjust to me. Let's put that into a political and later a legal framework to make sure that everyone knows that you shouldn't murder, that you shouldn't steal, that you should be kind towards each other, etc., etc.
I think there's probably smarter people to talk about this than me. But it's if you ask me right now on a pure instinct level, without having read enough books on this, I'm sure that there was a feeling or desire, an observation of a higher being or a higher power that you kind of try to put into words. Right. And the interpretation of that for me has always been religion. But you're absolutely right that at some point, and that's the reason why I say it's an incredibly useful tool, if everyone believes in this higher being, this higher power, and then you try to enforce rules within society, you don't know what might as well connect. It makes enforcing it a lot easier and obedience a lot more important, which leads us almost right to the Western bubble as a religion. Yes, of course, right? Absolutely. I mean, there's so many examples within scriptures, right? From most religions that they're really just an observation of what are the problems of our times and how do we solve these problems, right? How do we make people's lives better? So of course, at some point, someone very intelligent, but someone in each society thought, oh, you know what? Now we have this interpretation of spirituality. We can all agree on this. This is an incredibly strong tool to lead and guide our lives. You know what? Let's attach some rules to it that we basically ascribe to that higher power, to that higher being. Incredibly smart people who did that.
But this is a very common issue with respect to global morality, such as human rights, for example, that the only way that you could have a moral framework that can be imposed from one society to another is if the whole world had one religion, believed exactly in the same codification, whether it's according to the Christian Bible or the Quran or Hindu texts. If there's one objectively recognizable moral framework, at that moment can you impose international morality? Right? Until the whole world believes in one religion, you will always have to be very careful with imposing your specific morality onto another society. And that's exactly where the Western bubble and human rights and democracy go wrong. Because they believe that they have that objective truth, but they have no basis for arguing that it's an objective truth.
Right, and it's so interesting with regards to the Peace of Westphalia, right? Hey, surprise, surprise, people 400 years ago were not that dumb and actually realized that, right, imposing your interpretation of the world on others does lead to a lot of suffering and violence. Yes, it took them a few hundred years to realize that. Okay. But they raised it at some point. And then you see, and this is why, right, why I will continue to say that the Western bubble is a religion or a substitute religion in that sense, because you see then this imposing of morality being taken out of Europe in that moment. And then you see secularization kind of being on the rise, and then societies kind of losing religion more and more, right? So now you have that element that I described earlier of, oh, we have a higher being that we can all subscribe to, and that higher being dictates certain rules that we all want to agree upon, now you can't, right? That momentum or that tool is gone. So now you go into a, I would say, more dangerous version of, and now we have to be careful now, right? And I don't want people to misunderstand me, of religious thinking, right? So religious thinking being in that sense, okay, connecting spirituality to policymaking for real life effects and impacts. Because now that is disconnected from religion and it is connected to what's right and wrong, right? So just on another level. So you would think that we're going in circles here, that we haven't learned anything from 1648.
Well, in many ways, so the lesson was forgotten, or was an enormously important lesson, which is a frustrating lesson that they understood in 1648. Namely, we can't agree on one framework, so we have to agree to disagree. That is the key lesson from the Westphalian framework. And now we're trying to override that, right? Now we're trying to basically overcome exactly that. And of course, we understand why, because it's frustrating. It is frustrating to see a world where things don't go according to your moral belief system, where things go wrong, where you see genocide, or where you see murder, or where you see hardship, where you see oppression. And of course you want to do something about it, but that's exactly what in 1648 was realized, that sometimes you have to be humble and modest enough not to do anything about it, even if you really want to intervene.
And to go back to the beginning of this episode, right, about the arrogance of atheists, now let me be arrogant for a second here as someone who's religious. Right. This is where I will now observe the world. I will observe society and say, ha, people are missing what religion brings them. Right. People are missing all these elements that are part of it. Right. So now we're no longer talking about the interpretation of spirituality, but we're talking about community. We're talking about guidance. We're talking about one thing that more or less everyone can agree on. Right. And these customs, traditions that are part of it. And here, this is where now my favorite topic comes up, and I definitely have to write a thesis about this at some point, right, is that thing of substitute religions. And I always compare this to football, right, because I'm also an avid football fan. And I, at some point, realized the many similarities between following a football club, or any sports team for that matter, and following a religion, right? Because you go to your temple, that's the stadium, right? You have your songs that everyone knows by heart. Those are your chants. Right? There's some form of higher power that is involved there, right? Because luck doesn't exist in our world. It has to be the football god. You also have that insider-outsider thinking, right? So I feel like that personally, for me, football, following a football team satisfies a lot of my irrational human behaviors. Right, is that I once every 2 weeks get to go to a stadium. There's an outsider, right, in another color. What a terrible person. I've never met him in my life, but he's cheering for this other team. And I can yell all my frustrations into the sky, and that it never reaches that person, right? So for me, that's a very good interpretation of that insider-outsider type of thinking, because I actually let it out, right? I don't let it build up and then turn it into policy at some point. And I do personally feel like I can see this in a lot of other elements, right? Because particularly when you don't have religion within your bubble, within your group, then you will naturally, according to me, this is my science now, according to me, you will come up with an alternative way of interpreting life. And that then becomes your dominant view. And this, right, can be done through football. This can be done through, right, your interpretation of spirituality. This can be done through a certain political ideology. And for me, the Western bubble is part of that, right? Is believing in human rights, believing in democracy, and all of that. And then kind of, right, that becomes your substitute religion, because what religion gives us in the end is something that I personally feel like all humans need. Otherwise, not all humans would come up with it.
But what's fascinating about this analogy is that it kind of shows our human tendency to look for community, right? To look for an in-crowd and an out-crowd. So again, that is a very good explanation for religion, at least for part of the rise of religion. It's a very good explanation for sports, as you mentioned. It is basically a manifestation of our human psychology to basically define ourselves according to certain standards, certain principles, whether it's about which club you support or not. And then say, I am part of this group And that means that I'm not part of the other group. But that then leads to the interesting question, Dario, that football wouldn't be able to exist if everyone supported Frankfurt, your club. But if that's is the case, then if everyone were to become a fan of Frankfurt, then football would collapse and people would have to invent new football teams to keep it alive. And isn't that kind of an issue with religion as well? That if everyone, what you see, for example, in the United States, inherently a Protestant country, but you have all these different denominations, if everyone were to become Catholic or Baptist or whatever it is that they, then within that group, you see, we'll see a splitting apart in order to still have the insider-outsider model. Basically, you cannot have a world where everyone believes the same thing because that doesn't fit into our human psychology.
Absolutely. And let me support this with another analogy from languages, because I at some point fell into this rabbit hole of thinking about, oh, what if we all spoke the same language? Wouldn't that be so good and so easy? And then someone who studied linguistics told me that, yes, right, you could basically do that. Let's say everyone from one day to another spoke the same language. But within a few decades, new languages would emerge, right? So first, this kind of turns into dialects, then it turns into languages and so on and so forth, simply because, right, we all live different realities, right? We have different surroundings, we have different cultural surroundings, we have different environments, right? You have different languages, you have emerging within even the same societies, right? For example, youth languages. So I think that's the same with regards to this, right? I said, yeah, we humans are inherently, right, inherently inward focused into our little group, and we will always find kind of similarities with a few others, whether that's genetics, whether that's interest in a football club, whether that's socialization on a religious level, whether that's I don't know, the philosophers we've read, we've always kind of find things to divide us up again. And then it's up to us who study international relations to make sure we don't hit each other in the head with sticks all day long.
But that aggression, and that sort of the aggression you mentioned with respect to shouting at the opponent in the football stadium, I will never forget being in Camp Nou in Barcelona, and there was this lovely family, really well behaved and dressed, sitting in front of us with you know, two children, a father and a mother, like the perfect family. And the game starts, and all of a sudden, the father starts shouting the most obscene things. This was Barcelona, Madrid, and against the Madrid supporters, all of a sudden turning into an completely different person. That kind of aggression is something that is inherent to human psychology as well. And that can be channeled through religion, can be channeled through sports, but it can also be channeled through modern day morality, right? The aggression that you see when it comes to moral debates, certainly on social media, certainly in the 21st century, where people are so convinced of their own superiority that they become aggressively intolerant of anyone who speaks another moral language. And so in many ways, That similarity between religion and modern day, if you like, secular moral debates, to me points to a frail and fragile human psychology more than anything else.
Absolutely. And that's why I think humanity relies on the emergence of interpretations, right? Whether it is religious interpretations, whether it's of a spiritual being or of democracy or whatever. That are very benign in that sense, and that are kind of focused on a peaceful coexistence.
That seems to me to be a great moment to end this conversation. If you have any questions, comments, or regards, make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today, and make sure to join us again, not next week, but in 2 weeks' time when we burst the Western bubble again. That is it from my side. And this time, to turn things around, Dario, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Well, so I don't know. I was struggling with this, thinking, do I pick something from the Bible? Do I pick something that Napoleon said? I ended up with something from the Bible, something that's very close to me and kind of tells you about my personal interpretation of religion. It's from Matthew 14, verses 30 and 31. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and, beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You of little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?"